Welcome to part two in the interview with Lars Anderson, plant physiologist and aquatic weed specialist. In this conversation, Anderson shares insight into how aquatic weeds got to Tahoe in the first place and how everyone can help prevent the spread of aquatic invasive weeds.
You mentioned earlier that subsequent to looking at the Tahoe Keys, you undertook a full Lake Tahoe survey to discern where populations of these weeds can be found around Lake Tahoe. What did you find?
Well, we looked at it in 1995, and then we went every other year or so after that, every year for about 6 years, and we're finding that it was spreading, not just staying the same, which you might expect, since there wasn't a lot of management of that. So it became more alarming that we were seeing a spread of it, and then in 2003, we found a new plant that we hadn't seen before called curly-leaf pondweed, a non-native plant from Europe and Asia. And it has the ability to spread very rapidly, too. So that just set off the alarm bells even further. And so I think what's happening now is that there's a realization, at least from the various agencies that are involved, that there needs to be some steps taken to stop this spread.
How you mentioned that in harvesting, the weeds are basically chopped up into bits, and these weeds sort of reminiscent actually of a Disney movie where the Sorcerer's Apprentice
break the broom
into a thousand bits and it turns into
a thousand bits.
It's sort of a good analogy here. So harvesting the weeds is actually causing the spread of new populations of the weeds. How else do they spread around the lake, or is that it?
Well, they do spread around the lake, not only from that, but also any boats that run through it and inadvertently just tear off fragments of it. There's some pretty good evidence that in general, birds, waterfowl can carry milfoil around as little fragments. It's not clear how much gets spread around by seed, but probably some does get spread around as the waterfowl might eat the seeds of the plant. And then the currents carry it around the lake, too. There's a lot of water movement and wind movement in the lake, and so once it's out into the lake proper, the main part of the lake, it can move quite easily around the lake. But a broader question is, in a sense, is how these things get started in the first place. And if you look at the history of the aquatic plant introductions in the U.S. starting in the 1940s or so, right after World War II, they started mostly in the southeast in Florida with hydrilla, which is a very, very aggressive plant. But it turns out probably most of those introductions were from the aquarium trade, from hobbyists who found these plants either in their tourism travels overseas in other countries, or maybe it has been speculated that part of World War II impact was that all these guys went over all these countries, found all these interesting plants and animals, and some of them decided they should bring it back and grow them. So we've seen a huge introduction through the aquarium trade, and that still goes on now. Some of it's regulated, but with the internet, you can still probably pretty much get anything you want, even plants that are prohibited by state or federal law.
So this is conjuring an image for me of someone in the Tahoe Keys, their fish die, and they have this aquarium, and they just take it out to the end of a pier and dump it in. Is that how we got the first?
Well, we really don't know. We know that's happened in a couple of lakes in California with hydrilla, because we found the tanks with the plants in them, and it spread in these lakes, small lakes. We haven't seen that. There's no history of what's happened in Lake Tahoe, to be sure. But what we do know is it started probably when the Keys was developed in the late 1960s.
So means of introduction and means of spread. You said that birds sometimes pick up these weeds and spread them. You said that through harvesting, that is just trying to minimize the extent of the weeds in order to let boats pass through passageways. By cutting them, we're actually creating the ability for them to multiply.
Right.
And then you said the aquarium trade. So those are three mechanisms by which these species not only move around the United States, but once they're in a lake like Lake Tahoe or in a part of the lake like the Tahoe Keys, they can move around within the lake. What else are we looking at within Lake Tahoe that is potentially moving these? Oh, you said currents.
Well, currents do, and probably the most important, sort of, we call it a vector, something that moves something around, are the boats within the lake. That even those boats that stay within the lake and don't leave, because they're leaving their dock, they're driving to some place, and even into the Keys to visit somebody or to just go in there, and they're of course running through all the plants, and as they come back out again, They're dragging the plants with them back to their own dock. Probably the most interesting thing that I've found up here in the last several years was a small patch of Eurasian water milfoil that we found on the California side that was this almost perfect rectangle. And it was very puzzling. Why? It's almost as if somebody planted it there. And it turned out, when talking to one of the neighbors, that the that there was a machine there fixing the guy's dock for about 3 or 4 months that prior year. And so it probably that machine, and those machines are often kept in the Tahoe Keys someplace just when they're not being used. My guess is that that whole piece of equipment got dragged out with plants, parked on that spot where they're working on the dock, and all these plants were there, and the fragments came off, and it just sort of planted this perfect little patch up there. But it was so distinctive, it was remarkable. So there's a lot of things that can happen in the lake, but anything that moves vegetation around the lake or moves the water around the lake has a likelihood of transferring plants from one location to another. The one good thing about Tahoe in terms of its physical nature is that a lot of the shoreline is either too rocky, too steep, and has too much wave action to allow the plants to get established. But there's still a lot of areas that are that have not been infested that could be.
What areas are particularly vulnerable then?
I think there's a lot of areas on the California side that it's sort of the protected side from the wind, and that's where this patch we found was. And so there's marinas around there, quite a few that don't have plants now that could probably support their growth. At the north end of the lake, there's some. I've been around the lake many times, and there's these small coves that maybe a couple of houses have them and share them, and those could be infested, but they aren't right now. So there's spots like that that have some protection, which would support the growth of the both the Eurasian water milfoil and curly-leaf pondweed. The other concern we have about curly-leaf pondweed, it seems to handle more unstable conditions, and so it probably has a wider distribution capacity than even Eurasian water milfoil has.
Okay. It just occurred to me when you were talking about these areas that are vulnerable for colonization. You mentioned that the milfoil is a nuisance in terms of boat traffic. It can be a drowning hazard where it's overly dense, that it's just not very pretty when you get maps of it. Does it do anything? You mentioned the chemistry. It changes the chemistry of the water. Does it do anything to the substrate? So if one of these small little local coves where just private residences are were to have an infestation of milfoil, does it change the conditions of the beach or of the substrate there?
Yeah, actually it does, and there's a couple of ways that it does this. Eurasian water milfoil has a lot of surface area on it, and that surface area tends to accumulate sediment from the water and from seasonal runoff and so on. And so what you find is where the milfoil has been for a couple of seasons, that sediment gets more organic loading than the areas that don't have the plants. And so it adds organic loading to the substrate, to the bottom. And then it also is able to cycle nutrients from the substrate, from the sediment, into the water column, because it's been shown in a couple of ways that phosphorus, for example, is taken up by the soil and then exuded out and leaks out of the plant itself in the water column. So it's kind of like a little pump. It's taking nutrients that are in the sediment and pumping them up into the plant tissue, releasing them. Of course, when these plants senesce in the winter, that gets released also. So it's kind of like this little system to cycle nutrients from the sediment into the water column. So there's a lot of ways that it affects the water chemistry.
So all of these studies that say that the most important thing to do to keep Tahoe blue is to keep the phosphorus and nitrogen out would indicate that Eurasian water milfoil is bad for keeping Tahoe blue?
Yeah, it's certainly bad for that from that standpoint. Probably the total runoff and the whole phosphorus budget is more important, but it's another good reason to keep some good management practices for Eurasian water milfoil and any of the other non-natives that might come into the lake.
So what can people do if we're not rocket scientists and we're not really involved in policy? What are things that the average person can do to help?
Well, the first thing is to not bring anything into the lake. And, of course, there are inspection stations in place now, which really helps a lot in that regard. And don't take anything out of the lake in your boat. Make sure it comes out clean. But if you have a house on the lake or you go on the lake someplace and use that area, you can actually hand remove these when you see them. And I ran into a property owner on the Nevada side few years ago when we were sampling, who had removed, he told me, garbage can fulls of Eurasmonas milfoil and completely cleaned out his small cove because I was surprised there wasn't anything in there. And he said, oh yeah, I used to have it a couple years ago, and we just kept pulling it out. It took 2 years to get rid of it. So you can do that, and I think the sooner you do that when you first see it, the better, and it makes it much more easily removed. But everybody should keep an eye out for these things and just take them off and remove them. If you're not sure, either call TRPA or Lahontan Water Board, and there's some 800 numbers to call. You can find out what you've got.
Okay. So basically you're playing in the water, you're swimming, having a nice beach day, and you see four or five of these weed fragments floating around. Your advice is take them out.
Get them out, put them in the trash can, or some of these is going to be pretty hard to do. There's a lot of fragments in some areas, but I think mostly being aware that when you see something that doesn't look like it should be there is to just call TRPA or someone, and it's better to be wrong about that than to pass something up which you should make somebody aware of, because the best way to control these things is to find them early. And that's been the case ever since people started trying to manage invasive species. It's that first few months or a year that you can get rid of them, and it just makes the whole process a lot more easily done.
Great. Well, thanks for your time today, Lars Anderson.
Oh, my pleasure.
And for all of your work on the lake and throughout California.
Thank you.
This is the end of the two-part interview with Lars Anderson. Thank you for listening at TahoeProject.org.